Usually in the public stock markets, there's this really comforting sense of precision. Like you pull up an SEC filing for a massive tech company, and the numbers are just standard.
Right, the disclosures are right there in black and white.
Exactly. The regulatory framework is basically a well-lit highway. You can see the guardrails, you know the speed limit, and you just generally trust that if a company says, "Hey, we earned $1 billion," there's this massive apparatus of auditors and regulators making sure that's true.
Oh, absolutely. The whole machinery of public markets is designed to be visible. I mean, it's standardized, it's relentlessly audited, and it's built on mandatory, continuous disclosure. You're operating in a very brightly lit room.
Yeah, but then you step into the world of Regulation D, the private placement world, and it's like suddenly someone just turns the lights completely out.
The safety net is totally gone.
Gone. The standardized 10Ks are gone.
Yeah.
You're just standing in the dark trying to figure out if this investment opportunity is, a generational wealth builder or just an absolute mirage.
Which is pretty much the definition of diagnostic muddy waters in finance. Because when those structural safeguards of public registration are stripped away, well, the burden of uncovering the truth has to shift somewhere else.
Right. And before we get into exactly where that massive burden goes, I should say this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got like a full series 82 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted, just like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com.
Highly recommend.
Yeah. So, okay, let's unpack this because today our mission is navigating this murky landscape. We are pulling directly from official FANRAI guidelines, SEC case studies, and the series 82 exam outlines to extract the absolute bedrock of due diligence and feasibility studies.
And, for anyone sitting for the Series 82, let's contextualize this for a second. In the grand scheme of the exam, this specific topic, due diligence, it might only represent a handful of scored items.
Right, it's like function one.
Exactly, function one, which covers half the exam, but the hyper-specific questions on feasibility studies. That's just a couple of points.
But we're spending a whole hour on it anyway,
Oh.
because those two points test the fundamental legal bedrock of absolutely every private placement recommendation you will ever make.
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't understand the mechanics of this, you don't just fail a
You
test.
destroy your career.
Yeah. You potentially bankrupt your clients and you end up on the wrong side of a federal enforcement action. The whole house of cards just comes down.
The stakes literally could not be higher because what we're dissecting today is the architecture of responsibility. In the registered world, the SEC does a ton of heavy lifting before a retail investor ever sees a ticker symbol. But in Reg D, that safety net isn't there.
Nope.
So the burden of figuring out if an investment is mathematically sound, legally viable, and, well, real, that falls squarely on the broker-dealer representative.
To help us wrap our heads around this, and to make sure these concepts stay absolutely locked in your brain for the exam, we're going to use a recurring cast of characters today, our little test case trio.
I love this. Bringing the regulations to life with application is the best way to master it, especially for folks who hate dry textbooks.
Exactly. So first up, we have Riley the Rep. Riley is our well-meaning, but let's be totally honest, deeply lazy broker-dealer representative.
We all knew a Riley.
Oh yeah. Riley loves the thrill of the pitch. He loves massive commissions, and he absolutely despises reading legal documents or asking difficult questions.
Which is, frankly, a highly dangerous psychological profile in the private placement industry.
You vary. Next, we have Ingrid the Investor. Now, Ingrid is incredibly wealthy, highly sophisticated, and accredited to the gills. I mean, she buys private islands for her rescue dogs.
Wow, okay.
Right. She has a family office that manages her family office. She doesn't even flinch at $1 million minimum investment.
She represents the ultimate high net worth target, the kind of client who can absorb massive risk, but also the kind of client who makes a rep's eyes light up with dollar signs.
And completely blinds them to reality.
Exactly.
And finally, we have Sam the sponsor. Sam is the slick issuer, the visionary guy. He's always pitching some highly speculative private placement. And for today, Sam is seeking capital for a blockchain-enabled high-tech alpaca farm.
Because of course he is. Blockchain alpacas.
AI-sheared, crypto-tokenized, genetically optimized alpacas. It's disruptive, it's synergistic, it's basically every buzzword on a PowerPoint slide. So we need to understand the foundation here. Before we look at how Riley conducts his due diligence, why does he even have to do it?
Right, like what happens if he just pushes paper?
Exactly. This brings us right to the legal bedrock. It's known as the reasonable investigation duty. A broker-dealer that recommends a security has to conduct a reasonable investigation of the issuer. But here's the absolute most critical part for the Series 82.
Listen closely to this.
A Regulation D exemption from registration does not excuse that duty. In fact, it kind of amplifies it.
Yeah, but let me play devil's advocate here, because I know how Riley thinks. Riley's sitting at his desk looking at Sam's alpaca farm deal. He sees it's Regulation D and he says, well, Regulation D is literally called an exemption.
Right, that's the legal term, exemption.
So isn't that like getting a VIP pass to skip the regulatory line? Isn't the whole point of private placements that the government stays out of it because these are private transactions between rich adults?
That logic right there, that is the misconception that ruins careers. And it is exactly the psychological trap the exam will test you on. We have to correct this forcefully. Regulation D is an exemption from registration requirements. It is not an exemption from fraud liability.
Let me say that again because it's the linchpin of this whole unit. Reg D removes the registration requirement. It does not remove the anti-fraud requirement. The offering isn't magically unregulated.
All right, it's just regulated by different provisions. So the SEC still very much cares if Sam is lying about the alpacas, even if he's only lying to billionaires in a private room.
Fraud is fraud. The Securities Act of 1933, the 34 Act, Finer's own rules requiring high standards of commercial honor, all of these still apply to the truthfulness of the transaction. You can't recommend something you know nothing about.
Because recommending a security without a reasonable basis is inherently a deceptive device.
Exactly.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, and I want to explicitly call out a common test trap for you listening. I call it the Ingrid defense. Let's build the scenario.
Okay, set the scene.
Riley is at his desk. He hasn't looked at Sam's alpaca business plan at all. He hasn't verified a single financial projection. But he's got Ingrid the investor on line one, and she is begging to invest $2 million into this crypto alpaca venture because she heard about it at some country club.
Right, FOMO is kicking in.
Total FOMO. And Riley thinks, hey, I don't need to do any heavy lifting here. I don't need to investigate Sam's farm because Ingrid is a billionaire. She's incredibly sophisticated. She has tax attorneys. She can fend for herself.
And if Riley chooses that rationale and you choose that answer on the exam, you fail the question. Boom, done. The regulatory rule is absolute. The fact that a customer is sophisticated and wealthy does not eliminate the firm's duty to investigate the issuer.
You cannot rely blindly on the issuer's pitch just because your client is rich enough to absorb a total loss.
But let's dig into the why there. I mean, if Ingrid has millions to lose and she actively wants to gamble her own money and she signs a document saying she understands it's risky, why does Riley have to play detective? Why doesn't the law just let wealthy people make their own mistakes?
Well, because the legal duty to investigate runs to the security and the issuer, not just to the customer. Accreditation, which we know Ingrid has, is just a wealth test. It's a metric to see who is legally allowed to participate.
Right, it's just the entry ticket.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But accreditation has absolutely nothing to do with whether the underlying security is actually a fraudulent scam or just mathematically impossible. The law says the broker-dealer can't substitute the customer's wealth for their own professional duty. You can't waive your anti-fraud duties just because the victim can afford to be defrauded.
Wow. When you frame it like that, it makes perfect sense. Wealth doesn't make a scam suddenly not a scam. An alpaca farm that doesn't exist is still a fraud, whether you sell it to a teacher or a hedge fund manager.
Exactly. So we really have to draw a sharp line here, a direct comparison.
Yeah.
Because these concepts bleed together all the time. We need to distinguish between product-level suitability and customer-level suitability.
This is a crucial foundational distinction. What we're talking about today, due diligence, investigating Sam's farm, this is all reasonable basis suitability. This is entirely product level.
Meaning, is this alpaca farm a legitimate, non-fraudulent investment for absolutely anyone in the world?
Right. Does the farm actually own land? Do the alpacas exist, or is Sam just generating AI images of poodles in sweaters? Is the business model rooted in reality?
Okay, so that's reasonable basis. Now,
yeah.
Customer-specific suitability is a totally different chapter. That's asking. Okay, Riley has proven the alpaca farm is real, but is it the right investment for Ingrid specifically, given her age, her liquidity needs, and her risk tolerance?
Do not mix those two up on the test. So if you get a question on the exam asking how a firm fulfills its due diligence obligation on a new private placement issuer, and one of the answers talks about verifying the customer's net worth.
Eliminated immediately.
Yeah.
Instantly. Verifying net worth is customer specific. Due diligence is investigating the issuer. Two distinct hurdles, and Riley has to clear both.
Got it. So Riley has to investigate Sam. But Riley is lazy, right? He's looking for a way out. Is there any regulatory shortcut? What if Sam's alpaca farm is actually a subsidiary of a massive, publicly traded agricultural conglomerate?
Like an SEC reporting company.
Exactly. What if they file 10Ks?
Okay, there is one very narrow exception, a shortcut. But you have to read the fine print carefully. If the issuer is a reporting company under the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, meaning they file audited 10Ks, 10Qs, all that public disclosure, Andy Riley's firm is not acting as an underwriter.
Okay, so he's just selling it.
Right. And there are absolutely no red flags. Then the fine RA says Riley typically could rely on those public filings to satisfy a chunk of his reasonable investigation duty.
So in that highly specific scenario, Riley just downloads the 10K from ADGR, reads it, and hits the golf course.
In theory, yes, because the SEC has already forced the issuer to undergo massive scrutiny. But here is the massive catch for the Series 82. Almost no private placement issuers are SEC reporting companies.
Right. That's usually the exact reason they are doing a Reg G offering in the first place.
Exactly. They're smaller, they're newer, or they just want to avoid the crushing burden of public reporting. So while this reporting company shortcut exists in the rule book, in practice, it almost never applies. Riley actually has to do the work.
Poor Riley. Okay, so transitioning here. We know why Riley can't just trust Sam's pitch deck and why he can't use Ingrid's bank account as a legal shield. Now we have to look at the scope. How deep does the hole go? What is the bare minimum required to keep his license safe?
And this is where the framework gets incredibly interesting because it's deliberately flexible. There is no universal one-size-fits-all script.
Mm.
The fine RA guidance explicitly states there is no fixed checklist that guarantees an adequate investigation for every single offering.
Let's pause right there. No fixed checklist sounds absolutely terrifying for a compliance department. I mean, their whole job is building checklists. Why wouldn't FINRA just publish a definitive 20-point checklist and say, do these 20 things and you're legally protected?
Because the moment a regulator publishes a fixed checklist, the industry turns into a brain-dead exercise. If they gave a checklist, firms would just blindly tick the boxes without actually applying critical thought to the specific risks of the specific deal.
I see.
Regulators want you to use professional judgment. The depth and intensity of the investigation depend on four main drivers.
Okay, what are the four drivers? What changes the scope?
First, the nature of the recommendation itself. Is it standard equity or some highly complex derivative? Second, the broker-dealer's role in the transaction, which we'll dive into later. Third, the firm's relationship to the issuer. Are they independent or affiliated? And fourth, arguably the most important one, the size, stability, and operational history of the issuer.
Let's make that fourth point real. Say Riley is investigating a 100-year-old steel mill in Pennsylvania, raising private capital to upgrade a blast furnace. They have a century of history, physical assets, banking relationships. That has to require a totally different playbook than investigating Sam's six-month-old crypto alpaca startup that operates out of a leased barn and a Discord server.
Precisely. The guidance literally states that a more thorough, aggressive investigation is required for newer, smaller companies. Sam's startup has no operating history, no proven cash flow. It relies on highly speculative tech.
So Riley has to rip the business plan apart at the molecular level.
Yes. With a steel mill, he still has to investigate the specific blast furnace upgrade. But the century of verifiable data provides a sturdier foundation, which shifts the scope.
I want to flag another major exam trap right here. This is how test writers leverage the no fixed checklist rule against you. The exam might ask how a firm proves they fulfilled their duty. And one option will sound incredibly professional, like the firm successfully completed its standardized due diligence checklist approved by compliance.
Oh, that is a trap.
It's a massive trap. You cannot use a completed internal checklist as an impenetrable shield. If Sam's alpaca farm has a unique vulnerability, say, a zoning law regarding livestock tokenization, and that wasn't on Riley's generic checklist, Riley is still liable for missing it. Mechanical checklists do not automatically prove a reasonable investigation.
Okay, so Riley has to use his brain. But surely FINR mandates some baseline requirements, right? What are the absolute bare minimums?
The guidance does provide a floor. There are five absolute minimums that a reasonable investigation must address in every single offering. Think of these as the five pillars. If one is missing, the investigation collapses.
All right. What are the five pillars?
One, the issuer and its management, who is running this thing. Two, the business prospects. How exactly do they plan to make money? Three, the assets held or to be acquired. what physical or intellectual property underpins this? 4, the claims being mode. What promises is the pitch deck making? And 5, the intended use of proceeds. Where's the cash actually going?
So translating that to our scenario, Riley has to know who Sam is. He has to know how monetizing alpacas generates yield. He has to verify they actually own the barn. He has to test the claim that alpacas can mine Bitcoin with body heat.
Good luck with that one.
Right. And he has to know what percentage of Ingrid's money goes to feed versus straight into Sam's pocket as a management fee.
That's a perfect translation. All 5 must be thoroughly investigated.
Okay, listener. If you're driving or walking right now, pause your brain and listen to this pop quiz. This scenario shows up on the exam all the time. Let's say last year, Riley actually stepped up. He was incredibly diligent. He conducted a massive, beautiful, perfectly compliant investigation into Sam's very first alpaca farm offering. Checked all 5 pillars. Flawless.
A rare win for Riley.
Exactly. Now today, 12 months later, Sam launches Alpaca Farm 2.0. Essentially the same business model, just raising capital for a second barn. Can Riley just take his beautiful file from last year, cross out the old date, write in today's date, and use it for this new offering?
I'll give you a second to think.
If you were screaming no at your steering wheel right now, you are absolutely right.
It's a classic, highly testable trap. The rule is unambiguous. An investigation performed for an earlier offering by the same issuer does not magically carry over to a later one. New deal equals new investigation.
Let's explain why. Why can't he reuse it if it's the exact same guy running the exact same business model?
Because reality is never static. In those 12 months, the macroeconomic environment might have shifted. The cost of alpaca feed might have tripled. The regulatory stance on cryptocurrency might have drastically changed. Plus, the assets being acquired for the second barn are different. The debt load of the company has likely changed. Riley has to start from scratch.
Okay, so we're talking a lot about this investigation process. And the exam outline uses the phrase feasibility studies, right alongside due diligence. We need to define this. What exactly is a feasibility study? Is it a specific form Riley has to download from FINRA?
No, and demystifying this is critical. It is not a regulatory FINRA rule. It's just an industry term.
So where does it come from?
Think of the feasibility study as the issuer's argument for why their business deserves to exist. Sam runs his own internal analysis to see if his crazy idea can work. He builds financial models, makes aggressive assumptions about wool production, vet costs, blockchain fees. He compiles all these projections into a document. That internal analysis, his argument, is the feasibility study.
So the feasibility study is Sam's homework. It's his pitch, backed up by his own math.
Exactly. The feasibility study belongs to the issuer. And Riley's job, his due diligence, is to take Sam's homework and relentlessly tear it apart. Riley isn't supposed to write the feasibility study. He stress tests it. He's testing the financial models against independent data. Does Sam's math hold up when it collides with economic reality?
So if Sam's feasibility study boldly projects, we anticipate 100% year-over-year growth because alpacas naturally reproduce, doubling our inventory for free, Riley can't just nod and say, wow, infinite money glitch.
No, he absolutely cannot.
He has to say, show me the biological reproduction data. Show me mortality rates. Show me the compounding cost of feed for a population that doubles every year. What happens to the price of wool if the market floods? He has to actively try to break Sam's model.
That is the essence of due diligence. He critically tests it. He doesn't just passively accept it.
So what does this all mean for how Riley actually organizes his day? Because there is so much data to sift through. Luckily, the regulatory guidance breaks the due diligence process down into 5 major buckets, 5 components to organize the work. And we need to go deep into these because the exam loves to try to trick you into categorizing an action into the wrong bucket.
They absolutely do. These 5 components are broad categories, and the unifying theme across all of them is that the rep must test the issuer-supplied claims against independent evidence. Let's start with component 1, financial data.
Okay, component 1, financial data. Sounds straightforward. Riley asks Sam for his recent financial statements, reads the bottom line, sees a positive net income, checks that it balances, and moves on.
Drop. Not even close. If Riley stops there, he is completely failing. Gathering historical financials is just the foundational step. The guidance specifically emphasizes 2 deeper elements, the issuer's internal audit controls and the structural trends revealed by the financials over time.
Trends. Let's unpack the mechanics of that with a real-world scenario. Let's move away from the alpacas for a second. Imagine Sam is running a software-as-a-service startup, a SaaS company.
Okay, much more normal.
Right. Riley looks at Sam's financials for the past 3 quarters. he notices top-line revenue is growing at 30% quarter over quarter. On a pure surface level, reading the bottom line, that looks like a wildly successful company.
It looks like a rocket ship. But what if Riley stops looking at just the revenue line and starts analyzing the balance sheet trends? What if he notices that while revenue is climbing at 30%, the accounts receivable line is exploding at 80% quarter over quarter?
Oh, let's explain what that mechanically means. Sam is booking the software sales, claiming the revenue, but the clients aren't actually paying their invoices. The cash isn't coming in.
Exactly. The trend reveals a massive fundamental flaw. Maybe Sam is selling to terrible clients with no credit. Maybe his software doesn't work, so clients are refusing to pay. Whatever the reason, a static read of the revenue looked fine, but the trend analysis reveals a massive cash flow crisis waiting to detonate.
So the reasonable investigation is supposed to catch that trend. It's actively analyzing what the data is trying to tell you about the future.
Correct. That's component one. Now, component two is industry and operational data. This is much broader.
What falls into this bucket?
It covers the macro environment, the specific industry, regulatory restrictions, competitive position. But crucially, it also includes the foundational governing documents of the issuer.
By governing documents, you mean the corporate charter, the bylaws, the operating agreement. Why does Riley need to read boring legal boilerplate?
Because they define the legal reality of the issuer. Riley needs to verify that Sam's company even legally exists in Delaware. He needs to read the charter to ensure Sam is actually authorized to issue the specific class of shares he's trying to sell to Ingrid.
Right. If the charter only authorizes 1 million shares and Sam is trying to sell 2 million, the whole offering is legally void from day one.
Exactly. You have to check the operational foundation. And component two also includes physical inspections.
If the business relies on physical assets, Riley actually needs to go see if they exist. If Sam says he has a state-of-the-art server farm, Riley needs to go see the blinking lights. And this brings us to a highly specific, very testable rule. Let's call it the geologist rule.
I love that name. The fine NRA guidance explicitly states that for an energy development or exploration program, obtaining expert opinions from engineers, geologists, and technical experts is treated as strictly necessary.
Let's break down why. Say Sam pivots to drilling for wildcat oil in West Texas. Riley has his Series 82. He knows balance sheets. But if Sam hands him a topographical map and claims there are 1 million barrels of oil under the dirt, Riley has absolutely no idea how to evaluate that.
None whatsoever. Regulators acknowledge that a securities license doesn't make you a petroleum engineer. You cannot simply look at Sam's map, guess that it looks promising, and recommend the deal. You are legally required to obtain an independent geologist's report to verify the physical operational data.
And that expert report falls squarely into component two, industry and operational data. Okay, move it to component three and listen up, because this is a direct comparison and a massive exam trap. We need to contrast component one, financial data, with component three, which is research.
They love swapping these on the exam.
Because if I hear the word research, my brain pictures going to a library and looking up numbers. So isn't research just looking at the company's financials?
No. And that intuitive leap is exactly what the test writers want you to make. Financial data is the numbers the issuer hands over to you. Analyzing those documents is financial data. Research, in the context of due diligence, means independent verification that does not rely on the issuer-supplied material.
So mechanically, research is Riley going behind Sam's back to see if Sam is telling the truth.
That is the best way to conceptualize it. If Sam says, "Our customers love us," Riley doesn't just read the pitch deck. Research is Riley picking up the phone, calling Sam's three biggest customers, and asking, "Does Sam actually deliver the software on time?" It's calling Sam's suppliers and asking, "Does he pay his vendor invoices on time, or is he always 90 days late?"
It's pulling background checks, researching pending litigation Sam might have omitted. It's active, independent verification. Financials equals Sam's numbers. Research equals Riley's independent digging.
Such a clear distinction. So let's move to component four, management and employee relations. Here's another psychological trap. When I hear employee relations, I instantly think of human resources, break room policies, 401k matching, whether the staff is unionizing.
Right. Is Riley supposed to be interviewing the entry-level coders or the people shoveling the alpaca manure?
No, absolutely not. The phrase employee relations in the title is notoriously misleading. This component focuses almost entirely on the top of the house, the executives and the board.
What exactly is Riley looking for at the executive level?
He's evaluating management's expertise. Has Sam ever managed a massive agricultural operation before, or is he just a crypto bro who bought a tractor? It covers regulatory history. Has Sam been banned by the SEC? Have previous investors sued him? It covers board integrity. And crucially, you will see this tested. It covers the amount and form of management compensation.
Let's dig into the mechanics of that. Why does a broker-dealer rep care how much salary Sam takes home? Isn't that between Sam and his board?
Riley cares deeply because compensation structure dictates behavior and it creates massive conflicts of interest. Let's look at a toxic scenario. Riley reviews the operating agreement and discovers Sam determines his own compensation. And Sam has structured his pay to receive a 15% upfront management fee based purely on the total capital raised, regardless of whether the farm ever makes a profit.
Oh, wow. So if Sam raises $10 million from Ingrid and others, he instantly pockets $1.5 million on day one before he even buys a single alpaca.
Exactly. That compensation structure reveals a fundamental conflict. Sam is financially incentivized entirely to raise money, not to build a sustainable business. He gets rich off Ingrid's initial check while the company starves. Riley has to uncover that during his review of management and employee relations. It has nothing to do with rank and file HR.
Phenomenal example. Okay, the final bucket, component 5, product development and expansion. The guidance says this includes reviewing the business plan, evaluating patents, and wait, let me pause and push back. The outline says component 5 includes testing financial models against representative assets. Doesn't testing financial models fundamentally belong in component 1, financial data? It literally has the word financial in it.
Nope. And you just stumbled into one of the most frustrating classic wrong answer traps on the Series 82. Testing financial models against representative assets, meaning stress testing future assumptions to see if targeted returns are mathematically possible, belongs squarely in component 5, product development and expansion.
Walk me through the logic of why regulators put it there. On the surface, it feels like a categorization error.
It feels like an error until you understand the timeline of the data. Component 1, financial data, is overwhelmingly focused on the past and present. Historical statements, past revenue, analyzing trends of what the company has already done.
Okay, past and present.
But when you test a financial model against a representative asset, like taking Sam's projection that a new barn will yield a 30% IRR, and comparing that against historical yields of similar barns in the industry, you are not auditing the company's past. You are taking their proposed product, their future business expansion model, and stress testing its viability. You are testing the product's future, not the company's past.
Oh, okay. When you explain the timeline, past versus future, that makes total sense, but it's incredibly tricky on a test. If the exam says Riley aggressively tests the issuer's predictive financial models to determine if the projected internal rate of return is viable, you must sort that into product development, not financial data.
Absolutely. You have to be able to sort the facts into the correct bucket. Accounts receivable trends, financial data, calling a supplier, research. CEO pays himself a 20% gross fee, management, stress testing future revenue models, product development.
Okay, so Riley is digging deep. He's sorting his analysis. But what happens when he finds something that doesn't just look like a bad strategy, but actually smells like fraud? What happens when he hits a red flag?
The concept of the red flag is central to private placements. A red flag is any information that would alert a prudent person to dig deeper.
So not necessarily a smoking gun that proves it's a criminal enterprise, but a massive alarm bell.
Yes. When a red flag appears, the broker-dealer's duty fundamentally shifts. The firm must do more than just rely on management's verbal reassurances. If Riley finds a discrepancy in banking records, he can't just call Sam, hear Sam say it's a clerical error, and move on. He has an affirmative duty to investigate further.
Give me a concrete example of a red flag in Sam's pitch.
The guidance specifically calls out promotional material that is overly aggressive. For example, promising unusually high guaranteed returns. If Sam's slick pitch deck guarantees a 400% risk-free return on alpaca wool futures within 6 months, that is a massive screaming red flag.
Because risk-free 400% yields do not exist in the real world. But let me throw a wrench into this. Riley sees the 400% claim. He's worried. But then Sam hands him the company's financial statements, and they are fully audited and unconditionally certified by a massive, prestigious global CPA firm.
Okay.
The accounting firm has stamped their approval on the math. So Riley can just exhale, trust the fancy CPAs, ignore the red flag, and move forward, right? The CPA firm assumes a liability.
Absolutely, unequivocally not. Pay close attention because this is drawn directly from real SEC enforcement actions. Let's call it the audited financials trap. The regulatory precedent is clear. A red flag overrides audited statement.
I mean, really? Even if it's a legitimate billion-dollar CPA firm, why doesn't federal law put the liability on the accountants?
Because the broker-dealer has an independent duty of reasonable basis suitability, the SEC has literally barred brokers from the industry for this. There was a case where a broker relied on financials in a PPM that were fully audited by an independent accountant, but outside of those financials, there were numerous glaring red flags indicating the company was a Ponzi scheme.
And the broker ignored the red flags because of the CPA stamp.
Exactly. The SEC ruled decisively that the broker could not justifiably rely on those audited financials when surrounding circumstances screamed fraud. The broker had an unfulfilled duty to conduct a further independent investigation.
That is wild. A shiny CPA stamp is not a get-out-of-jail-free card. If the numbers look certified, but everything else looks like a scam, Riley must investigate further. He cannot hide behind the accountant's signature.
Treat the words audited and certified in an exam question as just another set of facts to weigh, not as a magical force field.
And the SEC case law gets even more severe. Let's talk about the infamous dual failures case, because it perfectly illustrates how conflicts of interest compound.
This is a phenomenal case study. The SEC found a broker violated just and equitable principles of trade for two massive concurrent failures in the exact same offering. First, like our previous example, the broker willfully ignored glaring red flags in the financial projections. But second, and this is the compounding factor, the offering's PPM failed to disclose that the broker himself had a lucrative, ongoing consulting relationship with the issuer, and it failed to disclose the severe prior litigation history of the CEO.
Oh, wow. Let's apply that to Riley and Sam. Imagine Riley is secretly getting paid a $50,000 advisory fee by Sam on the side, and Sam is being sued in three states for defrauding previous investors, and the financial projections assume a 400% growth rate with no actual capital. Riley ignores the fake numbers, hides the lawsuits, pockets his secret fee, and aggressively sells the deal to Ingrid.
It's a dual failure. A massive financial red flag ignored, explicitly combined with an undisclosed conflict of interest. The exam might present a scenario with both, and you need to recognize both are distinct severe violations.
Okay, so red flags can be crazy mathematical claims or undisclosed conflicts. But what if the red flag is just behavioral? What if Sam just won't answer Riley's emails when Riley asks for data?
That's known as an issuer-created red flag. The issuer's refusal to provide basic information can constitute a massive red flag. If Sam is actively dodging questions or deliberately providing evasive or out-of-date info, Riley cannot just shrug his shoulders, log the attempt, and say, "Well, I tried."
The dog ate my due diligence defense.
Right, it doesn't work. If Sam is stonewalling, Riley has an obligation to determine whether reliable info is otherwise obtainable through independent research. And if it's not obtainable, if the black box stays closed, Riley cannot recommend the security, period. You cannot recommend what you cannot investigate.
Speaking of critical documents Sam might refuse to provide, this brings us to another major exam trap, the missing PPM, the private placement memorandum. This is usually the massive disclosure document laying out all the risks and financials. So listener, think through the logic of this. Riley asks Sam for the PPM. Sam waves him off and says, "Oh, we aren't doing a formal PPM for this round. Too expensive. We're just using a 5-page term sheet." Does Riley have to kill the deal immediately? Is a missing PPM an automatic, legally mandated failure?
I'll give you a second.
If you are thinking, yes, it must be illegal. Hold on.
This surprises a lot of candidates, but the answer is not automatically. A comprehensive PPM is not always a strict, absolute legal requirement under every provision of Reg D, depending on the specific exemption, the size of the offering, and the accreditation status of the investors.
Okay, but they're standard industry practice.
Exactly. Because they protect against fraud claims, they are standard. Therefore, the guidance states a firm must carefully consider whether the absence of a PPM is itself a red flag for that specific offering.
It's a highly fact-specific red flag, not an algorithmic disqualifier. So let's compare two scenarios. Sam is trying to raise $50 million from 50 investors for a complex blockchain startup, and he refuses to pay a law firm to write a PPM.
That is wildly suspicious. Definitely a red flag that kills the deal.
Right. But if Sam is just raising $150,000 in a seed round exclusively from his wealthy uncle and his former business partner, who both know the business intimately, maybe the lack of a formal $40,000 legal document is less of a glaring red flag.
Exactly. The context dictates the severity. Do not treat a missing PPM as an automatic pass or fail on the exam.
So far, we've implicitly assumed Riley is just an independent broker working for an independent broker-dealer. He's an outside party. But in the real world, relationships get tangled. What if Riley's role in the transaction is fundamentally different?
This brings us to a crucial section, the roles that shape the scope of the investigation. We established there's no fixed checklist, and the depth dynamically shifts based on the firm's role. Let's examine four specific roles. Role one is the affiliated broker-dealer.
Set the stage for that. What does that look like?
It means Riley's firm is legally or structurally affiliated with Sam's issuing firm. Maybe they share common ownership. Maybe they are both subsidiaries of the same parent company. Or the CEO of the broker-dealer is on the board of the alpaca farm. There is a structural tie.
Okay, so if they are affiliated, Riley already knows Sam. They go to the same corporate retreats. So logically, Riley can do Ellie's investigation, right? He doesn't need independent research because he already trusts the guys down the hall.
That is the exact opposite of the regulatory reality, and it's a massive trap. If Riley's firm is affiliated with the issuer, it drastically raises the bar for due diligence. It does not lower it. Famanera explicitly notes that affiliation typically raises customer expectations.
Right. Think about it from Ingrid's perspective. If she sees Riley's firm and Sam's alpaca farm share the same corporate logo, she naturally assumes Riley has deep insider knowledge and special expertise about this specific deal.
Exactly. She thinks Riley isn't just selling a random product. This is his own company's product. They must know it's a sure thing. That affiliation creates an aura of enhanced safety for the investor, which means the broker-dealer has a heightened duty to ensure that safety is real.
Oh, wow.
An affiliated broker-dealer must guard its independence fiercely. They generally have to investigate more aggressively and document it more thoroughly to prove to regulators they aren't just blindly rubber-stamping their affiliates' junk to generate internal fees.
Affiliation means more scrutiny, not less.
Got it. What about role two? Drafting the PPM. Let's transition to a new scenario to really capture the gravity of this. Sam is no longer pitching alpacas. Sam is now the CEO of a complex Series B healthcare tech startup. They're using AI to analyze clinical trial data. It's dense. It's raising $100 million. Sam comes to Riley and says, "My engineers are brilliant, but they can't write financial disclosures. Riley, your firm has great analysts. I want your firm to help me draft the actual offering document, the PPM." If Riley's firm agrees to that, if they actively help prepare the PPM or produce supplemental sales literature they wrote themselves, it triggers two massive fundamental shifts in their legal liability. First, Riley's firm now has an affirmative duty to investigate its own claims.
Right, because when they were just an independent broker, they were reviewing Sam's representations.
But the moment they hold the pen and draft the document, they are now making those representations themselves.
Let's explore the causal chain of that.
Yeah.
If the PPM that Riley drafts says, "Our AI algorithm has a 99% success rate," and that turns out to be a total fabrication, Riley is on the hook. He can't point the finger at Sam and say, "Well, Sam's lead engineer told me to write that."
Exactly. Under federal securities law, because Riley's firm drafted it, they own it. They are legally responsible for the truthfulness. Second, because they drafted it, the PPM now technically counts as the broker-dealer's own communication with the public.
Cool, which triggers a whole other set of rules.
A massive set of FINRA advertising and communication rules regarding fair dealing, balanced presentations of risk, and exaggerated claims. Drafting the PPM does not lower the due diligence bar. It raises it into the stratosphere.
Okay, so knowing Riley, he wants absolutely no part of holding that pen. He wants to do as little work as possible. This brings us to roles three and four, which I call the passing the buck traps. Riley looks at this $100 million healthcare AI deal, realizes he knows nothing about clinical trials, and says, "This is too much work. I'm going to hire an outside law firm to read the charter and a biotech consulting firm to evaluate the AI. I'll let the experts do the due diligence."
This is role three, relying on counsel or outside experts. And a firm may absolutely retain outside experts to help. As we discussed with the geologist rule, sometimes it's mandatory. But, and this is a massive but, for the exam, hiring outside help shifts the work. It does not shift the regulatory responsibility.
So if Riley hires a top-tier law firm, why isn't the law firm responsible if the deal's a fraud?
Because FINRA regulates Riley, not the law firm. Riley must carefully review the competency and independence of the experts. And more importantly, simply receiving a bound report from a consultant doesn't complete the firm's responsibilities. Riley has to actually read the report.
Right. If the expert's report has glaring gaps or surfaces new red flags, like the consultant notes, the AI algorithm relies on an expired patent, Riley has to address those.
If the law firm misses a massive structural fraud, the SEC still comes after Riley's firm for failing to conduct a reasonable investigation. He outsourced the labor, but retained 100% of the liability.
He kept the liability. Okay, what about role four, the syndicate manager? Let's scale this up. Say Riley's firm isn't leading this $100 million healthcare deal. A massive, prestigious global investment bank is the lead underwriter, the syndicate manager. Riley's firm is just a tiny regional broker-dealer invited to join the selling group to get a $5 million allocation. Can Riley just lean back and say, Morgan Stanley is leading this deal? They obviously did the due diligence. I'm just a small-time seller. I'll rely on the syndicate manager.
He can rely on them, but it is highly conditional. It is not an automatic blanket safe harbor. The exam aggressively tests the two specific mandatory conditions that must hold true for Riley to legally rely on the lead manager.
What are the two conditions?
Condition one, Riley's firm must have a reasonable basis to believe the syndicate manager has the requisite expertise and the freedom from conflicts of interest to perform a thorough inquiry.
Okay, so if the lead manager is a globally recognized investment bank with a dedicated healthcare tech division, they clearly have the expertise. Condition one is met.
Right, but condition two is where people trip up. Condition two, the relying firm must verify that the syndicate manager actually performed that thorough inquiry for this particular offering.
Wait a minute, are you saying Riley has to investigate the lead underwriter's investigation?
Yes. Riley cannot just assume they did their job because they have a fancy logo. Riley's firm should request a meeting with the syndicate manager, obtain a detailed description of the specific investigative efforts, ask probing questions about the thoroughness. They have to actively verify the massive Wall Street firm actually did the work for this specific deal.
And even if he checks those boxes, meets with the lead banker, gets the summary, verifies the work, is he totally in the clear?
Even then, the relying firm, Riley's firm, keeps its own unshakable responsibility for anything the syndicate manager's efforts do not address. If the manager's due diligence proves the AI product is sound, but they don't address a liquidity risk that makes it fundamentally unsuitable for Riley's specific customer base, Riley is still on the hook. Passing the buck is incredibly difficult.
Okay, so if we step back and look at the totality of this process, let's imagine Riley has a complete professional metamorphosis. He does the impossible. He didn't fall back on the Ingrid defense. He systematically dug into the five components, ordered the independent geologist report, aggressively investigated red flags and didn't trust the CPA's signature, interrogated the syndicate manager. He did everything perfectly, and the investment turned out to be totally legitimate. He's safe, right?
And not necessarily. In fact, he might still be found in violation of the rules.
Why? He did the work. He protected the client.
Because of Section 6 of our outline. Documenting the investigation, or as I like to call it, pics, or it didn't happen.
Oh man, the paperwork. It always comes down to the paperwork.
The paperwork is the only proof that exists in the eyes of the regulator. A firm demonstrates its investigation was reasonable through the written record it creates and retains, not merely through the underlying work alone.
I want to make sure I'm hearing the mechanics of this correctly. If Riley does 100 hours of flawless detective work, uncovers hidden truths, validates every asset, but he keeps it all in his head, or doesn't formally write down his process. Finara treats it like he did absolutely nothing.
Yes. We did the work, trust us, is not a valid legal defense without a contemporaneous written record. You must treat the requirement to document the investigation as a totally separate, equally important regulatory hurdle from the act of doing the investigation itself.
So what does the documentation actually have to look like? Is it just a sticky note in the client file that says, check Sam's startup looks good, approved by Riley?
No. We use what compliance officers call the reporter test. Think about the psychology of a FANRA regulator. They are reviewing Riley's file 3 years after the deal closed. They were not in the room. The written record has to answer the exact same questions a journalist would ask. Who was involved? What specifically was done? What did those actions turn up? And when did it happen?
So you need detailed records of both the process and the results.
Exactly. Process means retaining detailed descriptions of meetings held, specific tasks performed, exact dates, and who attended. And the guidance makes a highly specific note here. Records should cover meetings with parties beyond just the issuer.
Let's connect that back to our components. If Riley's file only has notes from his cozy lunches with Sam, the CEO, the regulator is going to conclude he didn't do enough independent component 3 research.
Precisely. You need the contemporaneous notes from the phone calls with independent software suppliers, the unannounced site visits, the interviews with outside geologists. That proves the process of independent verification.
And what about the results side of the documentation?
Results means explicitly documenting what specific information and legal documents were reviewed, like reviewed Q3 audited financials and the Delaware corporate charter, and what the analytical findings of those reviews were. Determined cash flow is sufficient for 18 months of runway. you have to capture both the physical action taken and the intellectual conclusion reached.
Okay, time for our final ultimate pop quiz for you listening. Listen very closely, because this is how they twist the knife on the exam. The exam stem reads, Riley conducted an incredibly thorough, aggressive investigation into the Series B healthcare startup. He visited the server farms, checked the audited financials against operational trends, interviewed the independent biotech consultants, and successfully resolved all initial red flags. The investment was totally sound and ultimately became very profitable for all his clients. However, his broker-dealer firm kept zero written records of his specific efforts. Did the firm satisfy the reasonable investigation requirement under FINRA rules?
I'll give you a second.
If you're hesitating because the deal made money, don't. The answer is no.
I cannot stress this enough. Watch for this exact psychological trap where a firm did undeniably adequate underlying work and the clients even made a profit, but the firm kept no record. The investigation still absolutely fails to demonstrate reasonableness.
Profitability does not cure a compliance failure.
Never. Documentation is not a byproduct of the investigation. It is the definitive proof of it.
Okay, my head is spinning in the best way possible. We have covered an immense amount of ground today. This truly is the foundational architecture of the private placement business. Before we close out, let's do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute top testable takeaways from everything we've talked about. I'll throw out the concept. You hit me with the regulatory punchline.
Let's lock it in.
Number one, Regulation D and fraud liability.
Reg D exempts the offering from SEC registration, not from fraud liability. You are still fully subject to all anti-fraud provisions.
Number two, the Ingrid defense.
The fact that your investors are sophisticated, incredibly wealthy, and accredited does not waive or reduce your duty to investigate the issuer. The duty to investigate runs to the product itself, not to the client's bank account.
Number three, standardized checklists and repeat offerings.
There are absolutely no fixed universal checklists that guarantee compliance. Mechanical box ticking is a trap. Furthermore, a new deal from the exact same issuer requires a brand new, fresh, comprehensive investigation. You cannot reuse old homework.
Number four, the difference between financial data and research.
Financial data is analyzing the balance sheets, income statements, and numbers the issuer hands to you. Research is active, independent verification, calling customers, interrogating suppliers, and checking litigation history completely behind the issuer's back.
Number five, management and employee relations.
This component focuses squarely on the C-suite. Board integrity, executive expertise, and most importantly, identifying who determines management compensation and analyzing if that structure creates a conflict of interest. It has absolutely nothing to do with rank and file human resources.
Number six, audited financials and red flags.
A glaring red flag completely overrides a CPA's audit stamp. If the numbers look perfectly certified but other operational facts are screaming scam kame, you have an affirmative duty to investigate further. You cannot hide behind the accountant.
Number seven, drafting the PPM.
If your broker-dealer drafts the private placement memorandum, it immediately becomes your own communication with the public. You radically elevate your liability and must now investigate and stand behind your own claims.
And finally, number eight, documentation.
Picks or it didn't happen. You need written records of both the process, the who, what, and when, and the results the documents reviewed and conclusions reached. We did the work but didn't write it down. Is a failing answer on the exam every single time.
Absolutely brilliant. Before we sign off, leave the listener with a final provocative thought, something for them to chew on as they grind through their practice exams this week.
Think about the immense, often invisible psychological pressure on a broker in Riley's position. You have a wildly wealthy client like Ingrid who is actively begging to get into a hot, exclusive, buzzword-filled private placement, and you have a charismatic issuer like Sam promising the moon, hyping up the returns, and applying intense social pressure to close the deal quickly.
Oh yeah, it's intense.
Every single financial and social incentive in that room pushes the broker to just sign the paperwork, look the other way, and take the massive commission check.
It's the path of least resistance.
Exactly. And that is why these rules exist. The reasonable investigation duty, this exact grueling material we covered today, is quite literally the only regulatory wall standing between market enthusiasm and absolute catastrophic disaster. The next time you see a news headline about a massive multi-billion-dollar private investment fraud completely collapsing, don't just ask what the fraudster did. Ask yourself, what did the broker's due diligence documentation look like the day before it all fell apart?
That is a chilling thought. Because when you're looking at an SEC public filing, the picture is usually clear. But in the private placement world, nobody is going to hand you a clear, honest picture of the risks. You have to build the machine, take the picture, and diagnose the reality yourself. And if you don't write down exactly how you did it, Feanor will assume you are flying blind. Keep the energy high, keep grinding on those cert fuel practice questions, and you are absolutely going to conquer this Series 82 exam. Until next time.